funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. There are things you just expect when you pick up a copy of The New Yorker. Incisive journalism, thoughtful social commentary, and brilliant short fiction, sure. But you also know you will find impeccable grammar, exemplary punctuation, and never, absolutely never, any spelling mistakes. Some of the best minds in contemporary journalism and literature furnish the ideas. Credit for the technical perfection of what we read, though, belongs to the unsung heroes known as copy editors, the passionate, detail-oriented obsessives who cannot rest until every I is dotted, every T is crossed, and almost every participle is rescued from dangling. Mary Norris has worked in the copy department of The New Yorker since 1978, earning great respect from her colleagues and something akin to a marriage proposal from Philip Roth. She shares her stories in her new book, Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen. Mary, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's so nice to talk with you.
You say one thing you love about your job is that it draws on your knowledge of lots more than just grammar and punctuation. How does it help that you know about cheesemaking and travel and gardening and plumbing?
Well, these things come up. Just today, I read a line about somebody recommending that alcohol be served in movie theaters, and he said that there should be a mandatory beer followed by a chaser of bourbon. And, you know, I happen to know from hanging out in bars that the chaser is the beer. And what you do is you have a shot of bourbon. So that's the kind of thing that I can catch and I can be helpful with.
What I love about your life story is that you ended up with what sounds like your perfect job, despite the fact that you did not start your working life with a plan that led you there. How does a woman who fantasizes about being a dairy farmer end up copy editing for The New Yorker?
Well, I guess what happened was that the dairy farming didn't work out for me. I had this picture of a pastoral life, and by the time I actually learned to milk cows and I was through with graduate school and it was time to make a living, I realized that if I apprenticed myself to a dairy farmer, I would have no life except getting up early in the morning to milk and then being there, and I would never be able to travel or get away. And then it came up that I had an opportunity to move to New York. So I'd wanted all along to be a writer. The cheese factory experience, the cows, all these things I thought of as experience. I enjoyed them, and I was sincerely interested in doing them. But I was also taking notes and filing things away. And I came to New York hoping to be a writer in a commercial way. There were opportunities to write in academia, but it was too dry for me. I just couldn't stay with that, and I decided to try the other option, which is commercial publishing. So you don't just walk into The New Yorker and say, "Hi, I'm a writer. I'd like to do talk stories and stuff like that." I was able to get an interview with the executive editor at The New Yorker, and I eventually got an entry-level position in the editorial library where we took the magazine apart. That is, we indexed it by the subjects of cartoons, and everyone whose name was mentioned in an article, we would have that on file so that it could be found later. But while I was doing that, I could see from my window up to the next floor where the copy desk was, and I envied that woman her job. She would get up once in a while and look in the gigantic dictionary to find a word, and I wanted to help put the magazine together. So I thought that would work out because I always had an interest in the technical things about books, you know, how they get all the words to come out even on the right-hand edge and things like that.
I guess all of the taking apart of the magazine now happens digitally, right?
Yes, a lot of the magazine now is, I guess you'd call it, desktop publishing. We don't have to send anything to the printer until it's actually ready to be printed. The proofs are generated in-house. We copy editors and page okayers, query proofreaders, we do work in pencil on paper, at a certain point during the editorial process, but then we switch and we make our changes directly on the screen in an editorial. Well, sorry, it's an electronic file. That's what it's called.
You have a particular affinity for one kind of pencil to the extent that like it really matters to you what you hold in your hand and what kind of mark it leaves on the page, and you will go to great lengths to get the right pencil.
Yes, well, you know, it's like a, well, this is kind of far-fetched, but you like your tools when you're working some kind of job. So I was going to say it's like a surgeon with a scalpel, but I think that might be a little far-fetched. It's just maybe more like a plumber with the right wrench. It just feels right in the hand. I'm talking about a number one pencil. I like soft lead, and I've gotten, so I really like Black Wings, the pencil that is famous for a lot of people use this pencil, Stephen Sondheim famously and Vladimir Nabokov. But they are, of course, artists, and I'm just using it to do my copy editing job. But I like the feel of it on the paper, and I've gotten used to it. If somebody leaves a number two pencil on my desk and I pick it up accidentally, I can feel that it's not right. It feels all hard and scratchy, whereas the Black Wing, the graphite, just melts into the page, and it's very expressive.
Do you like an eraser attached, or do you like a separate eraser sitting somewhere on your desk?
I do like a separate eraser. It gives me more room. You know, I sometimes write whole little essays on page proof, and nobody wants to read those. So after I've written them, I erase them. And you need a nice big block of an eraser. For more precise things, I can just use the one that comes on the tip of the pencil.
As you're aware, some people assume copy editors must be very rigid or, you know, bitter, frustrated novelists or something. How would you characterize your relationship, though, to the writers that you work with?
Well, I'm doing my best to be helpful. I used to think that it was, my character was being deformed by always pointing out people's mistakes. And, you know, I have a younger sibling who I once told that story to Dee, and she said, well, you should be good at that. I guess I pointed out the mistakes in my family for quite a while. And so I got a little bit embarrassed and ashamed of that, and I tried to think of the job as helping. It's very important to help as much as you can without imposing your own style on a writer. You have to see if you can channel the writer's style yourself. I mean, not that you're filling it, not that you're putting words in anyone's mouth, but that's exactly what I mean. You want to make sure that if you suggest a word change, that's a word that writer would use.
When you jumped up to the copy desk, was there at first an intimidation factor when you were called upon to check the work of men and women who are widely acknowledged to be among the best writers of their times?
Yes, it was very intimidating. Also, my colleagues were intimidating, and I worked with some of the premier copy editors and proofreaders in New York, and they were there for me to ask questions of. But sometimes it was intimidating to go to them and ask those questions. And as for the writers, and I've read short stories by John Updike in manuscript after they'd been edited, and those stories always were just pristine. You know, they would come in beautiful prose. And so I could really just sit back and enjoy reading them. There were plenty of people coming after me who would catch any mistakes, I thought. But, of course, you have to do your job, so I'd have to stay alert. And it could almost be deceptive. Somebody who wrote so well, they could lull you into complacency and you might miss something that really was wrong.
You have a great story. Very early in your career, before it was fully your responsibility, you managed to catch a mistake on a draft submitted by none other than Philip Roth.
Oh, well, this was... I was well into my career by then. It was a very small thing. The magazine was running the first few chapters of I Married a Communist, Philip Roth's novel, and it had already been gone over by the editors and copy editors at his publisher, I believe it was Houghton Mifflin. And this, you know, when things are at that point, they're polished, and they'd rather we didn't find anything, frankly, although, of course, if there's a mistake, they want to know. So Roth had quoted a long passage from a children's history book, and then he quoted it again. He repeated it toward the end of the section, and there was a tiny little discrepancy. And that is the only thing I remember catching in this story. I turned in my proof, and it came back from the editor, that's Bill Buford, with a note written on it that said, "Philip Roth on Mary Norris. Who is this woman, and will she come live with me?" So I wouldn't call that a marriage proposal. It's an editorial proposition. It's more like it.
Maybe a little more exciting that way. So you mentioned that sometimes it could be hard to go to the people who were above you and sort of ask them for guidance. Will you tell us about the fascinating and apparently terrifying Lou Burke?
Oh, Lou Burke was just, she was a crack proofreader. Her job was to read the fiction and also the cartoon captions and those things called news breaks that are the column fillers at the bottom where we catch, we, the New Yorker, made fun of other publications' mistakes, which meant we had to be very careful and not make our own mistakes. And Lou Burke did not make mistakes. And she was mean. I think she did like to point out other people's mistakes. She certainly didn't hesitate to. But you could take a question to her, and she would give you a straight answer, I'll say that. And she would rather have you ask an ignorant question than to continue being ignorant. But she was, she did have some, I think, frustration in her life that made her kind of lash out at anybody who was in her way when she was in a bad mood.
How did she feel about commas?
Oh, Lou thought we overused commas at the New Yorker. And she sat right next to Eleanor Gould, who was a grammarian and very logical. And she was somebody who she read everything in Galley. That's, you know, the first version that comes out after we've copy edited something. And what Lou disliked about what Eleanor did was that she said that Eleanor imposed her personal preferences on the copy. And Lou would never do that. Lou respected the voice of the writer. And she was the one who worked on the fiction. And there are two schools of punctuation. There are probably more than that, but the people who put in commas to suggest grammatical, whatever is underlying the sentence grammatically, and to subordinate things like dates and things that are what we call non-restrictive. And that is what the New Yorker is famous for. It's called a close style of punctuation. And I think, well, you know, Lou was getting paid to follow style, so she did. But I think she relished the opportunities in fiction to break style sometimes. And that's why she kept on her desk this thing she called a comma shaker. It was just a canister with perforated lid, and she had wrapped paper around it and drawn commas on it. And that was her comment on New Yorker style, that before a piece went to press, we just sprinkled in the commas. But really, there is a reason for every one of those commas.
We're speaking with Mary Norris, who is a copy editor at The New Yorker and author of the new book, Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Summer Youth with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. I'm speaking this hour with New Yorker copy editor Mary Norris. Her new book is called Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Mary, your work requires you to be an excellent speller. Explain for us, though, why The New Yorker seems to have its own system of doubling consonants in words that are acceptably spelled in many other places with just one. Words like labeling and marvelous would have double L's.
Yes, well, we're completely used to that, and I use it always in my personal life now, too. I guess I'm brainwashed. It must have begun with the early editors of The New Yorker, Harold Ross, of course, and style editors who were working with him. They wanted to put out a magazine that looked sophisticated. Now, Americans have always had a little bit of an inferiority complex about our language, and the British system always seems a little more, let's just say, higher class. So I think that's probably what Harold Ross was thinking of when he wanted to use the double consonants in those words the same way that the British do. It's also possible that he was just filling up columns of space. They took up more room. And in the grand days of The New Yorker, when there was so much advertising, maybe they just needed to fill the columns. But I think it was an Anglophile touch.
Mm-hmm. But does spell check object when you double those consonants?
All the time, yes. We always have to go back and put that mark in over the objection of spell check. Of course, somebody has fixed the computers at The New Yorker so that our program allows those double letters. But if we work in Microsoft Word, it always objects. The spell check always objects to the extra L in traveler, say. And you feel, well, in my personal life now, I'm less likely to go back and fix those. I don't think it makes a whole lot of difference. But, of course, in the magazine, you want the uniformity of style. It's what people expect, and it looks right to have the word spelled the same way if it occurs twice in the magazine.
The New Yorker is also famous for using the diaresis. Did I say that right? The little dots above a doubled vowel in certain words?
Yes.
Okay.
You said that perfectly.
Good. Well, give us the argument in support of the diaresis.
Well, there are basically three ways to handle those kind of words, like cooperate and re-elect, and I guess there are some others. There are three ways to do it. You can hyphenate them, you can run them all together, or you can use the diaresis. The hyphen looks a little mechanical. It looks a little wooden in there. And, of course, most publications make cooperate one word and they don't worry about a hyphen or a diaresis. The diaresis at The New Yorker, it's kind of traditional. It's almost, I guess, our trademark. We could do without it. But there are many words that just don't look right run together, and they don't look right with a hyphen. And the diaresis is our solution for that. We think it's elegant, and it may be a little old-fashioned. I think maybe people out there are scoffing and saying, old-fashioned, it's downright archaic. It has been old-fashioned since perhaps the 30s, I think. But you know who appreciates it are people who English is their second language. Mm. It's an aid to pronunciation.
Having been there now for 37 years, how would you say The New Yorker balances tradition, an editorial style and tradition, against the evolution of language and usage?
Well, we are a conservative force on the language. And I don't think that's a bad thing. There will always be time to do the new thing, to make something that is now two words into one word. It's going to happen down the line. I saw the word container ship in a piece the other day, and the dictionary had it all one word, container ship. And our
sounds
style
like the state of being
had,
a container. Excuse me for interrupting.
Doesn't it? That's exactly what it looked like to me. So our style book still had it as two words, container, ship. And so that's how we printed it. So, and there are words like backyard, back seat, that we still hear that the second element of that has its whole own accent on it. It's stress. It's like equal with backyard, front yard. And the dictionary will close those up. Backyard. Of course, it's still pronounced the same way, but modern English, modern American English makes it one word. I think what we're doing in our by being a conservative force on the language is we're just trying to preserve connections to the past. You know, the future is inevitable, and we'll get there. But in the meantime, it's I think, valuable to see how it used to be done and to keep doing some of the things in the traditional way.
You include multiple references in the book to the brilliant Brian Garner, who, as you may know, lives here in Dallas and has been a guest on this show several times. Is it about Brian Garner's approach that inspires your trust?
Oh, it's so even-handed. You can tell that he's a lawyer. His lawyer's training obviously influenced the way that he puts things into words himself and his judgment of things. There, when you read him closely, there's no doubt where he stands on everything that he writes about, and I enjoy that. But mostly he's just done, he's had people do an immense amount of research, so there are tons of examples in the book. And I like his system at the bottom of every page saying, you know, things are either accepted completely, or I think it's a 1 through 5 system where people will think you're vulgar if you say this. And there's that spectrum that everything falls on. And so he's clear, and he's really thorough. And I think it's as I said, the even-handedness. He doesn't seem to be pressing his own case the way that, say, the linguists do, the descriptivists. They always tell us that we're too fussy and we should let everyone talk just the way they talk. But their books get copy-edited.
Mary, how do disagreements among copy editors get settled? Does everybody just, you know, whip out the what you call the little red web and go to town, or what happens?
Well, we do have a bit of a usage panel of our own going at work. When, for instance, when I thought container ship looked funny, all in one word, I emailed one of my colleagues who knows a lot about the shipping industry. And all she had to do was point out to me that it was in the style book. I should have looked there in the first place. But we consult each other when there's a word that we have to decide whether to capitalize it or not. And we generally get a consensus. It's always good when you have a feeling that a thing should be a certain way and you go to one of your colleagues and that's what she thinks too. Then you feel good about it and you're more persuasive in getting the editor and the writer to accept it.
Many of us might imagine that great writers would never dangle any participles. But as it turns out, these come up fairly often, and fixing them, this is so fascinating to me, without destroying the rhythm of a sentence or a piece can require a lot of really careful thought.
Well, yes, dangling participles do occur. I think even the best writers stumble into them. I do it a lot. Sometimes you just think, oh, I've finally found the right way to express this, and then you realize it's dangling. And there are two ways to fix it. People know what we're talking about, that getting used to being on the radio, she leaned into the microphone and spoke. Now, that's correctly used. That getting used to modifies the she, the subject of the sentence. If I were to say getting used to speaking on the radio, the microphone bothered her less and less, then that would be a dangler, because it's not the microphone that's getting used to being on the radio. So there are two ways to fix that. You either change the subject to match the participle, or instead of a participle, you make that phrase its own clause. You just say, as she got used to being on the radio, the microphone bothered her less and less, or the other way around. So you have to make the best possible change to that to make it this. It's usually the simplest change. And if you can't do that, you really have to just point it out to the writer and say, you have to rewrite this sentence. Please recast.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Ann in Richardson. Hi, Ann.
Yeah, hi, Chris and Mary. I love this show. Mary, I wanted to ask you to weigh in on two things. One, do you think diagramming sentences helps people write better? And two, I'm a big fan of Roz Chast, and maybe you could comment on her style in writing. Now hang up now.
Thanks for your call.
Well, diagramming sentences teaches you the parts of the sentence. I don't know that it makes anyone a better writer necessarily. It couldn't hurt. I don't think it could hurt anyone. I only had about 2 days of diagramming sentences when I was in a third grade. I don't recall that it was a big part of our curriculum. But people who enjoyed it still do it. They still like diagramming sentences. And I would say of Roz Chast that she is, of course, brilliant and creative and fertile artist, and we all enjoy seeing her work, and we do get to look at the cartoons, and there's a lot of writing right in Roz's cartoons. She does include a lot of words in her cartoons, so we get to make suggestions there. We just, you know, we don't do anything with Roz's jokes. They're brilliant. We just have to sometimes suggest a spelling thing. Even Roz Chast has to double her L's, you know.
How different is the editing when you are working on a piece of fiction where the voice of a character or the narrator may really be different than the standard voice of the New Yorker style?
Yes, you have to tread very lightly on those kind of pieces. The person that I think of is George Saunders, whose narrator is often an uneducated guy, and he's keeping a diary, and you don't want to polish it beyond what George Saunders wants, because there's a rough quality to the voice and to the prose, and if there's a dangling participle in there, that's what George Saunders wants, you know, so you have to leave that alone. Our nonfiction writers at The New Yorker, of course, are also world-renowned for their great writing, so we are very careful with them, too. But in a piece of fiction, you have to allow for the narrator and the character, and there's a lot of dialogue. So although we do still spell things The New Yorker way, we will let characters speak the way people speak.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Back to the phones now. We have, looks like, Kayla on the line in Louisville. Hi, Kayla.
Hello. I just had a question on what your current opinion is on, I guess, are they called copy editors? They do the spell check and the grammatical check after the computer's done it? Because I've looked at news stories online from my local news stations, and I see so many spelling and punctuation errors that my spouse and I have to ask ourselves, like, do the editors look at this before they post them?
Well, of course, somebody must be looking at things before they post them. I hope so. I don't trust spell check completely myself. I always use it because I'd be a fool not to. I run a spell check on everything at some point while I'm reading it. But the spell check, as you know, does not take into account context. It was invented by humans, but it is not quite as good as a human still. So what happens, I think, online, things that are posted on the internet are, well, the problem is that there's just so much of it that I don't think people can possibly give it the kind of attention that we have the luxury of giving pieces that run in the print edition of The New Yorker. The imperative online is variety and change, and things are going up so fast at The New Yorker, we have a dedicated bunch of copy editors. Bunch is probably not the best collective noun for copy editors. I ought to be able to do better than that. A bracket of copy editors, maybe? Anyway, we do have people dedicated to copy editing the things that are going on the web, and they're young people, and they are working really hard and really fast under hard conditions. So of course, the idea will be to raise the internet to the standard of print. It just is going to take time, and the people have to have more experience.
In your personal life, you are not a fan of autocorrect. I gather that it's not really used at work. But talk about, even you are susceptible to accidentally hitting send before you've realized that you're sending exactly the wrong phrase or word.
Yes, I don't know what it was I sent today, but what bothers me about it is that it makes up a word. If you do create a typo, which we all do on our cell phones, it's not easy to see those little letters. It'll make up some completely crazy thing. My example in the book is that I tried to write a friend who knew a little German. I tried to text her, Gute Nacht, good night in German. And the spell check just was not having any of the German, and it came out cute nachos. So that was my sweet dreams to my friend.
are there particular authors, writers, journalists that you know will always be a little bit of a harder slog than others? You don't have to name names, but...
Oh, well, thank you. Actually, my favorites of the writers to work on are the ones who do leave a little bit for me to do.
Hmm.
I like being able to put in the commas, and it makes me feel like I'm earning my living just to fix the spelling and to untangle some of the syntax. Of the writers that are really not that much fun, and I won't name any names, I will tell you that the expression at work, hot potato, does occur sometimes, and that just might be somebody who is resistant to change and insists on changing back to however the way he had it was in the first place, even if it's illiterate.
Mary Norris is with us. We're talking about her new book, Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen, back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Summer Youth with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is New Yorker copy editor Mary Norris, who has just published a new book called Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Mary, is it the copy editors who furnish the corrections that have to be run in the magazine? I know it's rare, but it does have to happen.
No, the editors do that.
The editors. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So when there is a mistake that has been made, it's you would never make a correction for a copy mistake, assuming that it didn't make the information incorrect. But I wonder if you discover after publication that something has slipped by you or a member of your team, is it something you have to process emotionally?
Oh, yes, for sure. When we get a letter sometimes saying, pointing out a mistake in the magazine, of course I'm always hoping, oh, I hope I didn't work on that piece. But I'm not immune, we're human. And I'm not going to say that it's good. When you do find you've made a mistake, when you've let something slip through, it makes you more vigilant. And I always have a bad night's sleep after I've discovered that I left a mistake in. But I find that that's it. After one night, the humiliation has distanced itself and I feel better about it again and I can go on.
You got to get back on the horse.
Right, exactly.
How often do you find mistakes in published material when you're just, say, reading for pleasure, and how much do you let them bother you?
Well, when I first started on the copy desk, I couldn't read anything without copy editing while I was reading it. I didn't do it with a pencil in my hand, but I noticed everything, and I thought about writing to the publisher, and I never did do that. But it took a couple years before I could read for pleasure again. Now I'm fine. I do read a lot for pleasure, and I notice things still. I'll notice a typo, or I'll notice a choice in punctuation and think I might have done that differently. But it never interferes with my pleasure in the book if it's a good book. These, the mistakes happen, and there are different approaches to punctuation, and there's room for everybody there.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Jim on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Hi. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Great program.
Good.
When I was a senior in high school 100 years ago, our English teacher made us read the New York Times because she said that was the most grammatically correct newspaper in the country. And every Friday we would have to give a report on any errors we found in the newspaper. And I find your guest interesting from that perspective.
So, did you find a lot of mistakes?
No.
I always find, the New Yorker is a weekly, so we do have time to process things. I never find fault with anything I see in the Times because they do a huge amount every single day. I don't see how their copy editors could possibly, make a perfect paper every day, all of that, all of those column inches full of words. You have to, words break at the end, you have to get the hyphen in the right place, and that's when often the computer takes over and puts the hyphen in some funny place. And it's just hard to ride herd on all those words so much of the time.
So most of the writing that I do never ends up in print. It is just to be spoken aloud on this show. I will confess, though, that I'm nerdy enough that I loved your kind words about the value of a well-placed semicolon. What makes that particular form of punctuation so powerful and appealing?
Well, the thing about the semicolon is that if you do not know how to use it and you try to put one in, it's invariably a mistake, it seems. People think of it as just a more sophisticated comma. And it is a little bit like that, certainly in a series that already has internal punctuation, internal commas in it, in a series of things. Then you use the semicolon between the items. But otherwise, the semicolon has to be followed by a clause that has its own verb. And it's not just put in there because the sentence is extra long and a comma doesn't look like it will hold things together. A sentence can pivot very beautifully on a semicolon. There are many writers who use them really well. I think that people who have had a classic education, an education in the classics, that is, people who know Latin and Greek, they have had to use semicolons when they translate because those sentences in those languages have so many subtleties that we can't reproduce in English without breaking them into different parts. So the semicolon is very useful for that. But it's kind of an upper crust thing, And I write in the book about Henry James's use of the semicolon. If you want to see how to use a semicolon, just read a few pages or a short work by Henry James. He uses them even in dialogue, and they can be the equivalent of a raised eyebrow or a smirk. They have a lot of subtle power to them, I think.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Kathy on the phone in Dallas. Hey, Kathy.
Hi. I just thought you might find it amusing. Many, many years ago, I was taking a fiction writing class, and our teacher instilled the fear of the big bad copy editor into us, telling us that if we did not make our copy clean and readable, that the copy editor would basically make it look the way they wanted it to, and it might not come out looking the way we had intended. And so it was that fear of the copy editor that pretty much drove me to make sure that I wrote clearly.
Your teacher must have had a traumatic experience having a story published at some point. It is true that I had that feeling myself when I was in high school. I was on the high school paper, and I wrote something. I was quoting a parody of a song. Our sophomore class made a musical comedy out of The Scarlet Letter. It seemed like it was easier than actually reading The Scarlet Letter. And one of the songs had the same tune as Along Came Bill, that song from the musical comedy Showboat. Mm-hmm. But we made it Along Came Pearl. She was 3 months premature. And I had put an L on the end of premature, and the copy editor came by, and just before it went to print, she took that out. And, you know, that to me, well, it made me mad, but that was when I was, you know, young, and it would still make me mad. It's the kind of thing that, you know, who would put an extra L on by mistake? Obviously, that was there on purpose, and that's the sort of thing that a copy editor should ask about and not take it into her hands to change.
You use this word multiple times in the book, stet. For people who do not have experience with copy editors and with editing copy, can you explain what it means and how it's used?
Stet is, I believe it's Latin. It means let it stand. And that is exactly what I should have written on premature when I was in writing for the high school newspaper. That means this is the way we want it. Do not change. You mark something stet if you think it's going to look like a mistake to the next person down the line who's going to read the piece and make that person want to change it. Stet just means hands off, let this be.
I know what I'm doing.
Right.
1-800.
We make a verb.
I'm sorry. You go ahead. You make a verb from stet.
I was just going to say we make a verb of it. You know, we stetted something.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go back to the phones now. We'll speak with Paul in Dallas. Hello, Paul.
Yes, hi. I have a question. I wonder how your editor keeps from going insane with the amount of horrible usages of words now that are so different from what we learned in standard English. How does she cope with that, and how does she, quite frankly, keep from just wanting to smash somebody? Thanks, Bob.
How often do you want to smash somebody, Mary?
I have not inherited the Lou Burke titles. Lou Burke would have smashed somebody. I don't smash anybody. I don't know exactly what words the listener is referring to, but I suspect it's probably something about slang.
Hmm.
And sometimes a new word, a new usage will come across my desk, and I have to query it. I think one of the things that I saw was hella, H-E-L-L-A. It was a hella party.
Oh, right.
And I know that's supposed to be hell of a, and the of a fell out, and it's just a hella party. And, you know, I do have the responsibility of deciding whether this piece of slang belongs in the New Yorker. And mostly, if it's a young writer and that's the expression, you let it go. It becomes part of the language. Once it's in the New Yorker, it'll end up in Webster's sooner or later, and they'll quote the New Yorker, and then, you know, you've aided and abetted the word hella. My only reservation is that I don't need to use these words myself in speech or in my writing. That would be, you know, somebody, you know how it's embarrassing when people who are older start speaking like teenagers or what we used to be valley girls. So I don't have to use it myself, and that's what we want to impress on your listener. Those words may bother him, but he doesn't have to use them.
There's a wonderful story toward the end of the book about the legacy that Lou Burke left that I have to tell you took me completely by surprise.
Oh, that's nice. Yes, Lou Burke retired early. She retired at her first opportunity, and she moved up to Connecticut, where she lived in a retirement place for some 20 years after she retired, quite a long time. And we were so surprised. Some of us did try to keep in touch with her, but she did talk so much that, you know, when if you stopped to see her, it would turn your trip into like a three-hour lunch, and you'd be very late for wherever you were heading. But it turned out when she died, we found out that she had left her estate to the library in Southbury, Connecticut, the Southbury Public Library, and she turned out to be worth more than $1 million. So, you know, not many copy editors have that kind of money in the bank. There were some theories. I mean, Lou was not overly generous, so she probably had a lot of savings. And, of course, she probably also had stocks and bonds, and she had a very efficient little Honda. She didn't have a lot of expenses. I don't even know if she used the public library. I do know she had books. Those were her friends. So, yes, that library was very surprised to find that somebody they didn't even know had left them this amount of money. And it got to be a little controversial because the chief alderman of the town decided that it was such an amount of money that he really ought to look into it. And he decided that actually the town owned the library, so the town was going to, he thought he could get Lou's money for the town. And instead of buying books with it, he could use it for snowplows and things. So there was an uprising, and the library board was able, it took them a while, but they do have control of this money, and Lou's money will be left for books. I was just up there the other week. They're still celebrating this bequest. They named the desk in the front, the circulation desk, is called the Lou Burke Memorial Circulation Desk, and it's a beautiful piece of cherry wood with her name on it.
Mary, were you a hot potato when you turned in your manuscript for editing?
Oh, yeah. No hotter potato than a copy editor. I had been asked by Norton, my publisher, if I wanted the book to be in New Yorker style or in Norton's style. And at first I thought, well, New Yorker style, that's what I'm used to looking at. But then I remembered that I expect writers whose work is accepted and published in the New Yorker to accept our style. And so I ought to cooperate and accept Norton's style. And I thought it would be more interesting that way, too. I'd see if things really made a difference if they were spelled differently. So I did have an efficient copy editor. He had some tics. I accepted a lot of things, and then afterward, I changed some of them back.
Mary Norris is a copy editor at The New Yorker and author of the new book, Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen. Mary, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you for making time for us.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a pleasure for me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.